Welcome to Keep Making Movies, the podcast where we explore, shall we say, movies that may have needed a bigger budget. We evaluate the movie for what it is, decide if it could have been improved with a budget, and if it will join our Keep Making Movies official recommend list. I'm your host, KJ, and with me is...
Tom.
Today, we are discussing Robert Aldrich's Kiss Me Deadly from 1955. This is Robert Aldrich's ninth of 37 feature-length films. And it's not quite a micro-budget film. So, audience, we are stepping away from our normal mode of operation for Keep Making Movies. And we actually have numbers for this movie. It cost about $410,000 in 1955, which at the time of this recording in 2024 is about $4.5 million. So way more movie than the movies we talked about in season one, but still smallish for the, you know, a star-studded film noir. Not, this isn't necessarily star-studded, but...
They have Cloris Leachman.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Right? She probably commanded a good chunk of change.
I don't think she was famous yet, but whatever.
In Kiss Me Deadly, we follow Mike Hammer, who almost hits an escaped prisoner. Mike gets wrapped up in a thick plot, which goes from person to person to try to unravel a mystery, for which most of the movie, he and we, don't know what that mystery is, really. Mike seems to have access to anywhere he wants to go by either rudely telling people to let him in, very rudely, audience, or literally just slapping them until they just let him do whatever he wants. It's a little out of control, to be honest. I don't know what the 50s were like, but hopefully it wasn't like this. In the end, it turns out there's a nuclear active something in a suitcase in a locker is what he finds. So the movie ends with Mr. Hammer being shot while our femme fatale opens the nuclearly active suitcase. Mike is kind of dragged away, luckily, into the ocean, which is lead lined, I guess. And then...
It is.
You know, the bomb goes off and blows up this house. Yeah. Right? The 50s, the ocean still had lead in it. It was before we had unleaded ocean. whew, audience, if you haven't tuned out yet, I don't know what's going on today. But that's Kiss Me Deadly. That's the general gist of it. There's a lot of characters, a lot of characters. They're all pretty silly. But Tom, what do you think the goals of the creator of this movie is?
The goals of the creator, when you read some criticism on it, is Cold War paranoia. That's why I think the ending really does matter.
Oh.
I think that's what they're going for. And it's interesting because the writer who was hired for this, A.J. Bezerides, that's B-E-Z-Z-E-R-I-D-E-S. I don't know how to pronounce that. He apparently was somebody quite suspicious of Cold War paranoia. He was not pleased at incorporating this element into the movie, but I think that's what they were going for. They were going for this kind of Cold War warrior thing, this kind of McCarthyist response, which is why in the end, when Mike Hammer finds out they have something nuclear, when the head of the police says, "I have a few words for you, a few letters. I'm going to say them in order. Doesn't really matter. New Mexico." You know, whatever else he says,
the Alamo.
Radiation. And he's like, "I didn't know," you know, and he's actually morally offended by the end. Mike Hammer, the one thing that morally offends him is communists getting nuclear suitcase. I think that's what they're going for. They're going for this kind of Cold War paranoia, and it's really interesting to throw it into the noir city, because the noir city is a jungle space. It's a modern jungle space. It's this perfect critique of the modern world, because it is absolutely, you know, like post-industrial type thing, and yet it operates like a jungle. It's completely dangerous. You could be grabbed, ripped out of it. It's utterly mysterious. And then in the center of this space now is this sort of paranoia about nuclear danger. And since it's a noir, the danger is real, obviously, because it's a noir. And so it's a really interesting way of getting at Cold War paranoia by not putting it in the suburbs and the American family with the dad who goes to work and the homemaker mom and all that stuff. Instead, you put it in the American jungle, the city, Los Angeles, that's falling down. It's filmed in Bunker Hill, Los Angeles, which during the filming and then very quickly after, a lot of that was paved over and developed. It was like a bad area that was done away with, so to speak. And so you have this like hole, and out of that grows this paranoia, and out of that grows this really true existential danger. And so it's a really interesting place to stage this paranoia. What do you think about the
I missed all that. I had no idea any of that was going on. And from my perspective, he didn't know what he was looking for. Nobody knew what they were looking for, except maybe the girl that almost got ran over at the beginning.
And the detectives, they have to.
I guess the detectives knew, but they were briefly in at the beginning of the movie, and then they were briefly in at the end, so they didn't feel like they were a big part of this movie. And then I'm not a, you know, a fission engineer or whatever, but I don't know that you can I don't know that you can leave it in a locker like that. I don't know what kind of suitcase that was containing it, that you could open it up a little bit, get a little bit of radiation poisoning, and then close it again. It's very interesting.
Suitcase. I don't know if the physics work, but I think that's what they're going for. And it's also clearly this is where Pulp Fiction comes from, the Tarantino movie.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure the scene in Pulp Fiction where they get the suitcase, I think that is citing this movie directly.
So it's funny you mentioned Pulp Fiction, because I had in my notes, do you think this was as obnoxious as watching the movies that came out after Pulp Fiction, right? Pulp Fiction comes out, and then everybody thinks they can write that, because it's not a very expensive movie, Pulp Fiction. You just got to write cool chatter and, you know, crazy things happening. Mm-hmm. Maltese Falcon was before this, obviously, right? Before this. And now all of a sudden everyone's like, man, I can do that. It's pretty cheap. Get a hat, get some suits, fast-talking guy. I wonder, was there a bunch of these, and this was just another one of these Pulp Fiction clones, Maltese Falcon clone.
Yeah, I think so. And Mickey Spillane, they filmed a lot of his stuff, and he wrote a lot too. And he wrote a lot up to, I think his unfinished manuscript was found in 2006 when he died, and they published a bunch of them between 2006 and 2013. So he's been publishing Mike Hammer books up to 10 years ago.
Wow.
from back in the 50s. And even Mickey Spillane, who wrote these books, actually played Hammer a few times in the movie. So yes, they are churning and burning with the noir. And the noir has been around long before Pulp Fiction.
Well, before Maltese Falcon.
Before Maltese Falcon, excuse me. I mean, you think of like the really good noirs of the 30s, which often have like a gangster element. The detective noir does come along later as well in the 30s, but yeah, they've been around for a while.
And so maybe for Adapt It, our other show audience, Adapt It, go check it out if you haven't, where we explore adaptations. I wonder if we do the Mike Hammer one that the author's in.
That might be good. This is probably the most famous. Kiss Me Deadly. I think this is very well regarded critically, and I think with good reason. So that might be something to take a look at if we do detective fiction, the Mike Hammer noirs, and compare them. Because he is an unusually violent and harder to
like. He just starts slapping people, and they seem, they're just like, oh, okay, now I'll do it. Like, it's very strange. The reaction to that is very strange.
Yeah, he's like the uber tough guy. And they made him more heartless in this than he is in the book. In the book, he is engaged to a nice woman who is also like his assistant, but she's, you know, they seem like they're getting on fairly well. In this, his assistant, he's having a romantic relationship with, but he's also using her apparently to seduce men to get them in compromised positions so as to blackmail them.
Yeah, and he does the same thing as well with the females. And it was that really weird scene. That was the first scene with the detective. And it's like the cops giving us the backstory by the cop asking the question and the other cop giving the answer. And then Mike Hammer just being like, yeah, kind of.
That's a weird scene because he refuses to answer any questions, but he doesn't actually know anything. All he knows is he knows what they know, which is this woman ran away. Oh, he knows. He definitely knows less, but he doesn't have anything new to give them. But it seems to be one of these things of the anti-authoritarian figure that often pops out in noir, which is that's why you have a private eye. Either you have a noir, you either have the private eye who's not part of the police, and the police are either bumbling idiots or part of the problem. They're part of the corruption or whatnot.
Which in this one, they're not bumbling idiots and they're not part of the problem. This one kind of subverts that, I guess, by just making them empty, keeping them out of it until...
until the end, but they turn out to be right. They turn out to be the moral arbiters in this. And when they say, yeah, this guy's kind of a low life. He's kind of a low life.
He really is.
Yeah. He's not a good guy. And he's keeping his mouth closed and not talking to the detectives because he thinks he can make some money off of this. That seems to be his motivation. You know, the one time we see him actually have a heart is when the garage, the guy who runs the garage, the Greek man who runs the garage is killed. And then he's disappointed. He's really sad and he gets drunk.
Right.
But outside of that, I think I can make some money off this. So I'm going to make some money off this.
So going back to the paranoia, I don't know if they did a good job with that. If that was one of their goals, maybe I'm just jaded or maybe paranoia is different today in the 2020s than it was in the 50s. But I think during our first impressions last week, you talked a little bit about the overacting or underacting, might not be the right word.
I think the lead actor just isn't fantastic. And I think
if you're going to do paranoia,
Ralph Meeker,
that's got to come from a lot of the acting. And I don't know if this hit it. I didn't catch that at all. I just thought it was supposed to be mysterious, not paranoia-ish.
Yeah. I mean, it's inherently, when you realize what's going on, that's the Civil War, the Cold War paranoia, right? Is that, oh my God, there's a bomb planted by someone. We don't really know who these people are.
Yeah, but when was that? That was the last 8 minutes? Last 12 minutes?
We find it, but it recasts everything, right? In the end, it turns out to be, oh, there's bombs being placed in the center of our cities, da-da-da. And there's also a conspiracy going on. There's a conspiracy to do something. They don't know what it is, but it involves a thing that must be worth a lot of money.
But would you say there's paranoia in Maltese Falcon? It's different. It's not paranoia.
I think there's paranoia. Sure, there's paranoia. I mean, in the last scene, everybody has to stay there overnight in Sam's apartment while somebody gets the Falcon because they're all so paranoid that they're going to get betrayed. I mean, the end of Maltese Falcon is Sam getting everybody paranoid against everyone by saying, who's going to be the fall guy? I mean, that's why he does the fall guy bit in the Maltese Falcon, because he wants them to go at each other. That's where his advantage is.
I think you're right. It feels like such a different paranoia because it's orchestrated. Whereas Red Scare, whenever I imagine Cold War paranoia, there's not a face with it. It wasn't like, oh, that guy is making us paranoid, which makes it a little bit eerier. It feels like a different type of paranoia to me.
Well, who would be the face of this? We don't meet the doctor who's responsible for this until the very end.
Well, I thought it was the guy that owns the pool.
Yeah, he's part of it, but I think the guy who knows everything who's behind it is the doctor. This is part of the problem with the plot. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, no, it doesn't quite add up. I don't know. It felt like there was a face given to this paranoia, whereas when you watch, like in high school, when we watched Red Scare stuff, right, when we watched like, oh, all the actors are being blacklisted, like those movies, there wasn't a face with it. And I don't know if they just didn't show McCarthy in those movies, but
So. Well, McCarthy would be the... So in this example, McCarthy would be the protector, right? The face of it would be like a Soviet agent or something.
I guess, but in the movies that I was shown in high school, the paranoia was not the communist. It was the threat of being called a communist.
Oh, okay. So the paranoia would be the people who are paranoid.
Yep.
That's what you mean by the face of paranoia, not the thing.
No, the thing.
Paranoia.
The thing. I forget. I think Jeff Garland was in the movie. And it was like, oh no, I don't want to admit that I was at this meeting because mm-hmm. then I'm going to be labeled a communist, blacklisted, and never be able to work again. So the mm-hmm. paranoia wasn't that there were communists and they were coming to take the states. The paranoia was, I'm going to be accused by the United States of being a communist.
Oh, I think this is, oh no, the communists are here.
Right.
Yep. Right. I don't think it's, oh no, they're going to accuse me of being a communist. And, you know, it's also, these people may or may not be communists. We don't really, they just seem to be opportunists. They want to sell this thing and make money. And so we ultimately don't know who the buyer is. Well, we never find out who the buyer is. Right? Right. The doctor says, like, I could tell you how to sell it, but don't open it. And then he dies.
Right.
I don't know why he's so kind to her in that moment, but.
And now, like, the scene with the guy with the key is really funny now that I'm thinking about it. Yeah. He's like, yeah, I don't want to have to fence this nuclear bomb. You know, it's just not easy. The atom bomb black market, it's just not, you know.
It's not what it was.
You used to be able to walk down to a convenience store and sell it to the Libyans, but nobody wants that anymore. You know, the other thing, I knew it was radiation because I saw his mark, mm-hmm. but when they open it, it chants yes. similar to how an Indiana Jones, when they open the Ark of Covenant, it yeah. chants. So my first thought was, maybe it's the Ark, right? Maybe they went where the top men put it. Like, I didn't quite know until I saw the radiation burn. I thought, huh. Maybe it's so valuable because maybe God's in the box. Like, I didn't quite get that it was the bomb because of the, right? It was a human voice that was overlaid mm-hmm. on top
singing
of it.
Singing or chanting, whatever it is. Yeah.
So, yeah. Again,
it's very creepy.
It was creepy, but I think the movie was a little unclear. But if you were living then, obviously that would have stuck out to you, mm-hmm. right? The audience would have known that. Well, how do you think they did with the money they had, Tom?
I think they did fairly. I think they did very well, actually. It looks great.
It does. The shadows and the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And one scene in particular, I want to mention the cinematographer, Ernst Laszlo, who had a very long career in Hollywood. He's a Hungarian-American cinematographer who worked for a long time. But anyway, the one scene in particular I want to mention, though there's a bunch of them, is the pool scene. So at one point, Mike Hammer, he gets a lead from someone that there's this kind of mob boss who, he might be a mob boss. He seems like he's a mob boss. And to go to his house to get some information, like this guy knows what's going on. And this mob boss becomes sort of the antagonist. But he goes there. And the scene in the back of the house is a pool, and there's a bunch of mobsters, either in suits or in bathing suits, doing deals at tables around the pool in the light. And either they're listening to a radio and making bets on horses or doing
poker,
other things.
Or playing poker. Or gin rummy. Sorry, it was gin. Gin rummy.
It was gin rummy. But it looks amazing. It's one of these things where there is a explanation as to why those people are there. They're doing something, they have a function, but it's also, why are they all just standing around the pool? Like, why are they sitting around the pool?
Yeah. And how does he get in? He just happened to pull up at the same time as a woman, and
as the sister. Yeah.
In this movie, anytime Mike Hammer meets a woman, they make out. They don't introduce each other. They music, cue the music, make out time. And because of that, he's able to get to the pool. But then he's like, hey, I'm just going to go into your pool house or whatever that was. It's like a video game character. In a video game, you walk into people's house, you open all the chests and the drawers to see if there's, you know, in-game gold in there or whatever. That's what he does. He goes into the pool house, and then the mob boss was like, what's that guy doing there? Hey, go get them.
Well, they know him.
Oh, they know him.
They know him at that point because they tried to bomb. Did they try to bomb him by that point?
They tried to bomb him. Okay.
So they know who they're dealing with.
So why did they let him in the house?
I got the impression he was allowed to come in by virtue of instructions to the woman who describes herself as the mob boss's sister, though I don't think she was his sister.
But even so, so he shows, oh, I guess so from their perspective, she brought him there. But so he just got lucky, and the makeout music, I guess the makeout music helps a lot of this plot.
Move well, it's actually. Also, it's kind of like, all right, this guy's here. Let's, it's kind of convenient for them. Let's kill him.
Let's get him, right. But and he also has the superpower to be the one what wins the fights.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost wins. All the time, yep.
Yeah, yeah, which is, the fight sequences are kind of fun. He just sort of punches them and they die. They just
like a video game.
Yeah, yeah. But then the guy, the head boss comes in and sits down and it's like, okay, I'll buy you off.
It's like, yeah, I like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
It is a gorgeous scene, Tom. Back to your point. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's good. And I like the impersonalness of it too. And I think you see that in the French New Wave. It's a style choice, right? The fact that it makes no realistic sense, I don't have a problem with, because I think that's the style of the thing. He's a guy, a woman walks out, they have a slick, casual conversation, they immediately make out, they walk around, no one is surprised that this guy's here. He just goes into the pool house. It seems to be, like you're saying, like a game. Like there's this unspoken set of rules that transpire in these dangerous spaces, that as the space increases in danger, it's almost as if the more clear for these people what the rules are, but less clear for us. Mm-hmm. And so it just comes off as almost like alienating. Like that scene also, as beautiful as it is, it's also alienating. Mm-hmm. Like this woman is just there for him. He just knows what to do. They're, now step two is, okay, make a deal with him. They can't, et cetera. I mean, it's really interesting, and I think it was really influential as well.
Another scene where the rules just are strange to us but make sense to the characters is when the detective first visits Mike Hammer. He comes in and pours himself a drink. Yeah. And then as he's leaving, hands the glass back. And Mike mm-hmm. Hammer's just like, yeah, yeah, that's how you do that. Like, that's, yeah. Right? Like,
yeah.
I wouldn't respect you if you didn't just take my alcohol. Like, it's a weird...
There's a tough guy thing to it. It's what, you know, usually call it like a predicative style, where you just say what you want or what's happening without ornamentation. I mean, I think that the noir... and also, you know, you see this with Hemingway writing as well, even though Hemingway is not a noir writer, but he does write tough guys, right? He's kind of famous for that, is that you don't have any flower, any kind of decoration. You just do the thing. And so you don't ask, hey, can I have a drink? You know, hey, buddy, how you doing? You just do the thing. Because, you know, yeah, you just own the space, and then he owns the space, and then you fight over the space, and then... You know, it's the type of thing.
Comes out on top, yep.
Yeah.
Oh, so, but going back to how they do with the money, it is a well-made movie, especially compared to season one, even compared to Pier 23, right? It's a better made
movie. Yeah, Pier 23 movie. Seems like a television movie that...
Right, like a made-for-TV, yep.
Yeah,
but
it's a B. It is a honest
B. Literally, yep. One thing I noticed is the dialogue felt like they already knew what the other person was going to say. Maybe this comes down to the acting, but it's almost like they started their lines a little too soon sometimes. Like, whoa, you couldn't have heard and processed what they said, but you already had a witty comment. Like, you started that witty comment before it was logically possible for you to have that comeback. There was a lot of times where I was like, man, this doesn't feel natural, because the only... It's like you've already been in the shower and was going through the argument in your mind and said, oh, I should have said that. And then you got to say it before it happened. Like, it was... So that was weird. Sometimes the ADR was a little off. Mm-hmm. It was just a few select times where the dialogue did not line up with what was being said, or somebody's mouth wasn't moving. And I don't know why, it stood out more than in... I mean, that happens a lot in movies. We just don't normally notice. Like, they do a pretty good job of hiding it, but this one I could tell. Sometimes they would talk about things that were right there, but they didn't show them. I'm thinking in the gym when he's like, hey, is that your new boxer? Yeah, doesn't he move great? And we never actually see anybody boxing. Like, they could have just turned the camera around real quick to somebody in the ring or whatever. He even calls out to him, hey, shadow box for a little, but we never see it. We just see him talking about it. There's a few times where it's like, if you could, I don't know if they needed more money or what, but you could have shot the thing they were talking about.
Yeah, it's an interesting... The consequence of it is interesting, because what you have is you have tight frames in which you rarely see solo characters. You have these conversations where both people are kind of shoved into the frame together. There's usually a lot going on, right? Even in that boxing scene, you see the two of them shoved together, but there's bunches of people in that room, in that boxing gym, wandering around in the back doing
things.
There
are, in the background, yep.
Yeah. And so it's just the whole frame is flooded. So instead of doing the back and forth shots to have the conversation, what you do is you pack all of these people in into this like crowded, sweaty space and have the conversation go on there, which has this really nice effect. First of all, it makes the movie feel feel claustrophobic, which it's the irony of the city is it's both jungle and endlessly open, right? This like you never see the same pharmacy twice, but you can't tell the difference. It's that type of place. But at the same time, it's always crowded and it's always claustrophobic and always something can always jump out at you or is touching you or, you know, something like that. And I think maybe it's the money problem. And so they just have to do these shots like, listen, we can't cut back and forth. We have 2 hours to do this. That's it. We're getting one shot. But the consequence of it is, I think, it really fits the genre quite well, which is this kind of crowded frame, which is we're not going to go back and forth. More often than not, they'll pan the camera, then they'll go back and forth. So I kind of like that. Even though, yeah, you're right. I think we see the beautiful guy boxing. Yeah.
They were going on about it. I was like, oh, let's see the boxer. I want to see somebody move like that, but couldn't see it. And I think we're getting close to the next question. Do we think a budget would have helped the movie?
No, right? I don't. I would have liked. I feel bad riffing on the central actor, but I should say his name just to get it right. Ralph Meeker, but I don't think so. I do think the plot is sort of a mess. I'm not.
Either shoot more scenes. I think something was missing.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's just getting information from people. Like there's these like the when he goes to see the opera singer. Why is he seeing the opera singer again?
I don't know.
I don't. He goes to see it because that and the opera singer knows some detail that can help him. But I don't remember where he got the information unless it's from the garage guy.
Yeah, maybe he did go to visit that guy a lot.
The Greek guy was like working for him. That's why the Greek guy gets killed. But I don't remember like how he finds the opera singer. But
no, and people love to give him information. Like the guy that was carrying the bags up to that apartment.
Yeah,
he's like,
let
I have a
tell
secret.
You exactly.
I'm not gonna tell you anything, but I'll tell you. Yeah, if he was a D&D character, he just rolled a really high charisma.
Or that woman actually wasn't the roommate.
Right. Right.
So it could have been like, hey, if you see this guy, tell him where I am. Right? Because she ends up winning that game.
Right. Well, almost.
Almost
in the
until
end,
she
it was the bomb that won, right?
Until she was too greedy.
Too greedy.
And had to look at the bomb.
She looked at the arc. Don't look at it, Marion. Don't look at it.
Yeah.
One thing, it would have been nice if they spent some more money on the analogies like we had in Pier 23. I wouldn't have minded a few.
Yeah, they cut. Typically, Mickey Spillane novels have voiceover. There's a lot of voiceover. And that was deliberately left out.
I was going to say, yeah, I don't remember any.
Which I think works well.
Voiceover.
Yeah, I think it makes Mike colder. And I sort of like that. I think apparently they just seem to lean all in on that.
So Tom, does Kiss Me Deadly make the list for you?
I think it is outside the scope of what we consider a keep making movies movie.
Yep.
So I don't think it fits that list.
Yep.
I was pleasantly surprised by this film. I would love to do it for our Adapt It podcast when we do our film noir.
Great. Thing.
I think this is a very good film noir. I think it's very inspirational to not just other film noirs, but other film genres and what have you. I think it's deeply flawed, and maybe there's better ones to do, but if you're going to shove in a Mickey Spillane into a season on adaptation, I think this is the one to do.
Yeah. Why not? Yeah. It's also a note for me. Same reason. It's not in the spirit of keep making movies. But like you say, I don't know how to quite say this, but when I approach a keep making movie, I'm in a certain mindset, right? Like I'm about to hit play on something. And then something like this comes along and you're like, oh, this is quite good. So it's interesting that way too. So it's official. Kiss Me Deadly has not made the list. But we might watch some more of Robert Aldrich movies. I don't think he's able to make any more movies, but he made a bunch. 37. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, so we did Weekend at Bernie's 2.
Weekend at Rob's.
Yes.
3. Oh man, where he's like directing a movie and he's in there and they can
but he's
do
dead
it. And they're trying to like nobody knows. Audience, what's your favorite movie by Robert Aldrich? Let us know on social media at Talking Studios, and maybe we'll throw another one on the Keep Making Movies list for another bonus episode one of these days.
You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia, Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games, Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is, and Adapt It, where we explore adaptations in various forms. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. It may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Keep Making Movies wherever fine podcasts are found.
Stay subscribed and join us next time when we get back to more traditional Keep Making movies with Cube 2 Hypercube from 2003. Stay tuned for our first impressions of Cube 2.
Wow, Talking Studios.
Next week, we'll be discussing Cube 2 Hypercube. Tom, how was your watch?
It was good. It's not as good as the first Cube, which isn't, you know, the greatest work ever made. So Cube 2 is somewhat a disappointment because they sort of stepped down from Cube 1. I like Cube 1 because nobody knows what's going on, and there's this sort of idea of, which is my reading of the movie, which isn't confirmed in the movie, but I think there's some suggestion of it, which is nobody designed Cube. It's just like a bureaucratic collection of projects that it was kind of semi-dropped, but people kept just doing their work, and the consequence of it was Cube. That's my reading of Cube. I know they suggest possible other reasons why Cube exists, but I think it's just no one actually is in charge of it. It's just a bunch of people filling out their paperwork and doing their job, and the consequences it was Cube. Cube 2 offers a sort of explanation as to what this Cube thing is. And what I didn't like about it was that it actually is aesthetically much less appealing than the first Cube. The first Cube is multiple colored cubes and these sort of like almost like art deco decorations on the inside walls of the cubes.
Yeah, the triangles and stuff, the way they were shaped.
Yeah, it had this really cool kind of sheen to it, which was one of the things I appreciated, was they really did what they could with this limited space concept in order to decorate it up. They take all that away in Cube 2 Hypercube, and it's all white. There's no variation in the cubes. So it's just not as interesting to even look at. And the plot also takes away any kind of puzzle. There is something of a puzzle in the end, but it's not really a puzzle. You know, like it's not really a puzzle. We won't spoil it in the first impressions, but at least the first cube had something of like, oh, here's a puzzle and you could figure it out to figure out the cube system. That's not really what's going on here. There's a lot of like quantum physics hand waving, and the secret reveal isn't helpful in any way. It's just this one secret reveal. It does it. It does nothing for the plot. And so I would say this is less enjoyable, despite supposedly being four times the budget of the original Cube. I can't confirm that, but that's the rumor around these interwebs. What about you, KJ? How was your first impression of Cube 2 Hypercube?
Hypercube. Well, you know, I was excited to hear there was a sequel to Cube. I was like, oh, wow. Like, either Cube did well enough where, you know, somebody took inspiration from it and was like, you know what this needs? A sequel. So I was pretty excited to see where they were going to take it. Like, you know, maybe we were going to get outside the Cube. Maybe we were going to, I don't know, maybe learn more about the Cube lore, or was there going to be new contestants or whatever you want to call the people inside? I wasn't sure. But it was a pretty rough watch, audience. Actually, Tom, you read a great review on IMDb, and I don't know if that'll set the stage for the audience here. I don't know if you have that handy.
Yeah, so the review said, it concluded with, "But if you're a big fan of the first Cube and expect a little less, you'll enjoy Cube 2 Hypercube."
Audience, Cube 2 Hypercube is on Prime Video at the time of this recording. And we look forward to sharing our thoughts with you next week.
And the guy who plays the lead, whose name is... What's his name? Anyway, he was the guy who replaced Marlon Brando on the Broadway production of Streetcar Named Desire. So
there you go.
There you go. Yeah.
So he is absolutely Stella.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, audience. we're starting off. Our other show is so high shelf that we have to...
Oh, that was so good.
We'll have to go back and maybe watch some Weekend at Bernie's.
Next week on Keep Making Movies, Weekend at Bernie's.
No, I don't think that fits. I think it's got a pretty good budget.
Yeah, no, it doesn't fit at all.
I imagine he could demand quite a bit for two after that first one.